folks. If the left would do that a little bit more, so they can build their audiences that way, that's a way to do it. Don't make a liberal Joe Rogan. You know, get everybody, you know, and Midas Touch is doing this a little bit, right? They're expanding the number of podcasts and people that they have as part of their programming. And so you begin to see, oh, this is somebody I should be paying attention to. That's the way to do it. Find ways to validate each other so you grow your audience bigger.
My guest is Mara Einstein, an internationally recognized expert on deceptive marketing tactics. She's also a professor of media studies and a former advertising and marketing executive. We're talking about her latest book, Hoodwinked, How Marketers Use the Same Tactics as Cults. And we're going to keep Mara on for an extended conversation, which you can get online at our website, risingupwithsonali.com. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, host and executive producer of this program. Rising Up is an independently produced, subscriber-supported program nationally syndicated to radio stations, free speech TV, and podcast platforms.
This is Judy Berry from Earth First, and when I'm in Portland, I listen to non-commercial community radio, KBOO Portland. No compromise in defense of the truth.
It's time to pack your trunk and join us for Camp KBOO. Make a summer of memories with KBOO and support grassroots media by becoming a member today. Go to kboo.fm/give to help us reach our $50,000 goal by June 29th.
To kick off Pride Month and celebrate Portland's LGBTQ plus community, KBOO will be hosting Queer Joy Fest on Friday, June 6th from 6 to 10 p.m. at the Foster Food Carts. There will be live music, vendors, food and drinks, and more. More information at kboo.fm/queerjoyfest.
1, 2, 3, 4. Y'all ready for this?
Ladies and gentlemen.
Jeremiah Wright Jr., you're tuned in to Hard Rock Radio.
No, Hard Knock. Just say this hard is knock. Hard Knock. Hard yeah, knock. So you just got to say this is Reverend Jeremiah Wright.
This is Reverend
and Jeremiah Wright, and you're listening to Hard Knock Radio.
Yo. This is Reverend Jeremiah Wright. You're tuned in to Hard Knock. Yo, keep it real, right? Hey.
Wait, one more time, because they're not gonna believe it was you.
This is Reverend Jeremiah Wright Jr. And you're tuned in to Hard Knock. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you so much for your support. God bless you.
It is Hard Knock Radio, Davey D, hanging out with you this afternoon. As you know, over the past couple of months, we've been doing a series called Build and Fight, featuring Thandi Chimaringa and Kali Nkuno out of Cooperation Jackson. This is part 4 of this series, dealing with worker power, self-management, and a path beyond capitalism. So without further ado, we're going to turn it over to Thandi, who is with Black Liberation Media and our sister station, KPFK, down in Los Angeles, and Kali Nkuno from Cooperation Jackson. So Sister Thandi, take it away.
Good afternoon, good evening. How y'all doing? This is Thandi Sizwe Chimaringa. And this is Root Work here on the Black Liberation Media platform. It is Tuesday, May 13th, and on this particular Tuesday, we're coming at you again with the fourth installment. I believe it's number four. Anyway, it's the next installment of our series in conjunction with Cooperation Jackson, presenting the Build and Fight formula with Kali Okuno, co-founder, co-director of Cooperation Jackson, based in Jackson, Mississippi. This is the Build and Fight formula, again, coming to you on Tuesdays for the rest of the year. A radical transformation for society. This is the offering of Cooperation Jackson for activists, organizers, individuals who are interested in what they can do to not only help free us, but to free the planet in order to save the planet. So, because we have a lot of information to cover, I want to bring Kali Okuno up. But before we start talking to Kali Okuno, let me remind you all, please like, share, subscribe. Like, share, and subscribe. Like this video before it ends. Share the link. If you're not subscribed to Black Liberation Media already, please subscribe to Black Liberation Media. Please subscribe to Cooperation Jackson's YouTube page, Jackson Rising, and please subscribe to my own page, Rootwork. You can find all of those on YouTube. So again, like, share, and subscribe. Hit some Cash Apps, hit some Venmos, hit all of that stuff. So Kali, welcome to the show again. Thank you again for putting together this series of shows detailing the Build and Fight formula. How you doing?
I'm doing good today. Doing good.
All right, so let's jump into it, shall we? This is installment number four, I believe.
That's right, number four. Mm-hmm. And today we are focusing on the need for worker self-organization and self-management to get us where we ultimately want and need to go. So that is going to be our focus today. Let me say off the top, let me just offer some recognition to some critical figures who made some valuable contributions to my own personal political development. And I think to the development of both the Black Liberation Movement and the organizing of the broad multinational working class in this empire. And that was Brother Tim Skimmerhorn, who passed, who was a leader of the rail workers in New York City. As a matter of fact, he helped to, under his stewardship, his leadership of the union, led the last mass transit strike that happened in New York City. And he was a big supporter of Cooperation Jackson and was always pushing us to kind of expand our practice in relating to the official kind of trade union movement, which we'll get into. And he was always keen to kind of highlight both to us and to others that cooperatives, of which, you know, we are more known for building, that cooperatives are just one tool in the toolkit of the working class to employ, you know, to own and control the means of production. And we'll be getting to that. So I just want to, for the official record, you know, because we forget too often our sheroes and heroes, and so we want to lift them up. The other being Brother Saladin Muhammad with Black Workers for Justice, who also passed not too long ago. You know, and it should be noted that, you know, both of these brothers, or folks understand the history and the connection, come out of particularly the Black Liberation Movement and a tendency within that movement, of which, you know, I myself, by way of family tree, if you would, come out of. And that was the African People's Party, the APP. And so, you know, Saladin was instrumental in the Black Workers for Justice, which still exists, operating in North Carolina and beyond, were very instrumental, I think, in raising the class consciousness of people like myself, and I would say thousands of others who are trying to carry on this organizing work. So I just wanted to give shout outs to those two brothers sorely missed, gone but not forgotten. That's a critical piece. And then also, just to give some depth to some folks who made some contributions to this particular piece in the here and now, that's a comrade of mine, Leif Call, who was working in the ILWU, the longshoreman, up on the West Coast, and to K. Dole Griffin, who works with teachers and adjunct professors up in New York City. We have been working on papers and political positions for many, many years separately, you know, called on them to both send some feedback on some old ideas and to get their sense of kind of where the, what I'm gonna call, you'll hear me say this repeatedly, official kind of trade union movement is in the United States at present. And we'll go into why I use that term a little bit later. But just to jump into it a bit, I want to encourage all of you who are watching or who may watch this in the near future. We're not going to do a review today, but I just want to encourage everybody to go look at the first three episodes. First was just kind of making the case. The second one was about the critical need to start around building organic links and solidarity through mutual aid and social reproductive and care work. That was the first of the series. The second was on the need around food sovereignty, and we really focused that one in less so on the kind of the methods as we probably could have, just given the limitation of time, but more on how different communities could and should go about securing land so you can actually start engaging food production wherever you may be in the different ways, particularly here in the United States, that can go about. So go back and watch 1, 2, and 3 and spread the word. I think that there are some useful tools, and we're going to try to provide some again today. Now, getting us started on this one, you know, we call this build and fight formula as a scaffolding formula, in that we want and need, in order for this to really build the kind of social and political powers necessary to kind of transform the world, we need these to build upon each other. And so let me just start by saying, building on those first, you know, episodes 2 and 3 in the series, that if you're engaged in mutual aid work and broad solidarity work in your community, you've started to mobilize some people and get them organized and starting to do the kind of necessary care work and other aspects of social reproduction that are needed to sustain an ongoing organized drive. Critical thing is you mobilize some folks. The second piece is, you know, we address the food sovereignty question on the backs of the mutual aid issue and the question, because from doing that work, hopefully we've done it in a manner wherever we may be, that we have ascertained more of the concrete kind of caloric, i.e. food needs that people in our community have. We've secured enough land. We are engaged in collective production on a mass scale, that we are both feeding those, you know, feeding people what they need, making some aspects of their cost of living and expenses go down, improving their overall health by improving the diets, getting us out of this fast food, processed food, over kind of indulgence that we are basically forced into, just given the nature of how food and food networks and food production value chains and supply chains are captured by major corporations. You've gotten out of that. But in the course of where it leads to this scaffold, in the course of doing that, you've largely organized people on a volunteer basis, because you can't really do anything like sell for market, particularly around food production, until you reach a particular level of scale. But the real object for what we're trying to do is get to a place where we are engaging in these things through mutual exchange, right? Labor, care work, exchange work, so that we can reduce our overall cost of living and amplify, you know, the productive capacity that our little Mother Earth brings to bear. Now, you've got people organized in these fashions. But the critical thing is you aren't touching at this point where they work, right, to earn their living. Given that most of us in this society, you know, roughly about 90% in one form or fashion, that is adults anyway, have to work for a living, right, to earn some wages, to earn some income, to be able to pay into the system of exploitation, which charges us rent, which charges money for food, for water, for power. We have to now figure out how to organize folks to exert greater power where they work. And I would argue, ultimately, how to control where they work. And that is why we say in this particular dimension of the formula, it's about worker self-organization and self-management. So critical pieces as to what that means. It means you're not being, number one, the self-organization. You're not relying on some outside force or government entity or some charity organization to come in and organize folks where you work. You're relying upon yourself and those who work at that place to do that organizing and to come up with the solutions that are necessary to exert power and ultimately to control the workplace. And that's the working conditions, the wages, and even, we'll get to what you do when you work. Like if you're producing certain items, i.e. commodities for sale, what types of things do you actually produce and why, right? And before folks think that this is somewhat absurd, I'll get to the point that there are places, this is where the co-op side of it come in, where people, where workers do make certain democratic conditions, i.e. within the confines of the market as it currently exists. But one of the critical things that we are trying to aim to, and I just want to state it directly, like one of the limitations of just doing cooperatives is that cooperatives can find better ways often to create better working conditions, oftentimes better wages, better hours for workers to work at, and then they engage in the market, but they don't change in and of themselves. They don't change the market. We ultimately have to change the market and shift it so that is more responsive to human needs rather than trying to fit a cycle of profitability and maximizing profits for a small group of property owners, including the places that we work. Right? So we're trying to get out of that. Mm-hmm. The piece around the self-management gets to this latter point of us not having to rely on a management class or a managerial class, right? Or the owners kind of dictating to us all the terms, conditions, hours, etc. But us doing that ourselves to determine how we live and under what conditions do we burden, if you would. Mm-hmm. These critical pieces of where we need to go if we're going to have really any serious opportunity at transforming this society. Because that is where the vast majority, given the nature of how capitalism has reorganized society, that for us to make our living, we have to make and earn wages. Mm-hmm. And then spend those wages to secure the goods and the products that we need. Well, we want to change that. But it starts with us changing us and being in control of that process. Now, we have an uphill battle to climb, particularly in a place like the United States. And let's bring up, Tanya, a couple of graphics as to what type of challenges in the real we are confronting. And while that's coming up, you know, we bring this up to just highlight that, unions on a federal level have really only been kind of permissible and allowable since 1935. Now there's exceptions to that rules in a number of different ways, but it was the National Labor Relations Act, or the Wagner Act of 1935, which allowed workers to form a body that could do collective bargaining, form collective agreements and contracts. So it's only 1935 where that really comes into play. And since that time, right, unions have tried to organize in the United States. It's different in different countries, but today we're primarily going to deal with the United States. Have tried to organize, you know, the working class primarily on a employment sector basis or employment base basis or a trade basis, i.e. the trade union piece, and to concentrate and build their membership and density around that. Now, that was a set of agreements that the Wagner Act kind of instructed that locked us into a framework that I'm going to just say, I was going to get to this later, but I'll say it now. Ultimately, in this day and age, we need to jettison, we need to abandon, we need to get rid of, because it's forming more of a limitation to our organizing abilities than it is an enabling factor. And we'll get into why a little bit later. But I want everybody to just, you know, take a good look at this map. This is from 2023. And I deliberately chose one that did not, you know, center on 2025, because it would look even worse. And in 2025, it is changing even more rapidly on account of what the Trump regime is doing via the instrument of DOGE, the so-called Department of, what was it, Government
Efficiency,
right? Efficiency, i.e. their slash and burn instrument. Where they particularly are just taking an axe to public sector workers and gutting those unions. And we'll come back and talk about some of the deeper effects when we look at this. But if you look at this, you look at that the Hawaii, which is one of the smallest states geographically and population-wise in the empire, has the highest concentration of unit density. And if you look there, it only scratches 25% of the working class in Hawaii, which means that 75% are unorganized in an official capacity. That is not leverage. It does not constitute bargaining power, except for in small, rare cases where this often specialized work, where workers have a degree of control and or a monopoly where they can kind of bring some demands to bear on their employers because, you know, it takes them a while to train new electricians or new engineers or new carriers to deal with the postal codes and things of that nature. You can't just, you know, pluck people into some of these jobs automatically and think they're going to be competent at doing them. They often take training and development, right? So that gives you a bit of leverage in terms of negotiating kind of with your employer. But as you can see, if you're only doing 25% out of 100, you don't have much leverage. The 75% are actually going to limit the scale of what you can demand in terms of wages and other forms of compensation like healthcare or paternal or maternal leave or childcare assistance. Those things wind up being very limited. And if you look at this map, it is not by accident that the places where the Republicans dominate the scene have the lowest concentration of union density. That is not by accident. There's a long period of organization on behalf of the Republicans and their reactionary forces in those states, and even laws that they passed, you know, like the Taft-Hartley law, which was passed in 1947, which you know, enabled what we call the right to work regime that enabled states to kind of opt out of certain sections of the National Labor Relations Act or condition it in certain kind of ways to give more power to the states and therefore the employers and therefore the kind of, you know, historically the dominant elements of the white ruling class, be they old plantation owners or old industrialists, which is still fundamentally the case. And if you look at the places that made state efforts to eliminate diversity, equity, and inclusion, it mirrors the same map. So you're dealing with the systemic nature of racism and white domination in this society that we are trying to and have to work to undo. So I want you to go to the next one, because I think it highlights a particular fact that we need to kind of contend with. And this is an important one. So that top line, right, if you look at it, is the total kind of density of union membership and by year. So if you look at it, the major spike and in the overall number of members, of people in unions, it spiked between 1970, really the mid-1970s, early 1980s, and then it's been just on a steady decline since. Mm-hmm. Some of the last figures that I've looked at, each successive year since 2019 is organized labor has each year brings new catastrophic lows into the number of people who are in trade unions. And if you look at the two bottom lines, what those track, right, the lighter color tracks organized forces in the private sector, right? That would be in your today's, you know, Amazon or Walmart, you know, the mega multinational corporations that exist and work in the private sector. That has been on a steady and rapid decline. Mm-hmm. And if you look at those who are in the public sector, that has been a slow but a somewhat steady increase. And it kind of flattens out around 2020 for a number of different factors, the pandemic being one. But if you look at it as of just within the last, 3 months, right? February, March, April, just those in 3 months, with the bull in the China shop kind of figures that Trump administration has done in terms of gutting federal employees, you would see probably a marked drop. And it's critical that in the private sector, where most employment in the United States is kind of centered, right? And just for the record, the United States, as much as the kind of capitalist propagandists want to talk about the private sector and the efficiency of the private sector and then more things need to be within the private sector, almost all of these things are dependent in one form or fashion on government largesse. I'm using their language, i.e., the tax base that me and you have to cough up every day, every week, every year in order to fund what should be public goods and services, which oftentimes go to these multinational corporations in the way of exclusive contracts or kickbacks, similar to what Elon Musk is getting with his SpaceX program, with his everything. I'm gonna leave that alone, but just we need to come to a particular point of understanding really how the U.S. government and the U.S. economy actually work and work to reinforce each other, and why this tariff war, this trade war that Trump is executing presents such a challenge to the working class in particular, and how much hurt it's going to be extracted on all of us, and why this building fight formula, I think, comes at an opportune time of us setting ourselves in position to exploit the contradictions that these policies and practices kind of force upon us, to kind of take it more of our own hands to control the economic and social dynamics in our immediate communities and through a federated sense, and then extract that out to larger and larger kind of aggregates, where we ultimately wind up controlling more of the economy. But it depends on our ability to do this type of organizing. So if you go to the next one, Tanya, I want to move just real quickly through a couple of these and then get to it. And this kind of highlights some of the pieces that wanted folks to just really look at. The Now, this doesn't cover everything in its broad sectors, but if you look at it, you know, the highest sector of union concentration right now is in the public sector. And if you notice, there's a little asterisk by there. And you know, didn't get to see this form, I will put it in the links. But that asterisk notes that that includes police people, firemen, et cetera, right? In the public sector. Remind you, those are public sector workers, and that is why it is 33%. Next are teachers in our public schools, 33.1%, so just slightly lower than the other one, which is around public safety, quote unquote. And then the next highest is in utilities. Most of those are also, to a degree, highly regulated, if not controlled, with public utilities. So the overwhelming part of the green is where the movement, the official trade union movement, is now. It's very heavily concentrated in and around government employee. And that is one of the reasons why Trump is taking the axe to those, because it's not like they are really saving any money, which is part of what their claim is. It's not like they are finding any corruption, and what they are calling corrupt are just things that they don't agree with. I hope folks are very clear with that. They don't agree with employing Black people. They don't agree with employing Latinos. They don't agree with employing too many women. They do not agree with employing queer people. And anybody who does employ them are somehow, according to their logic, engaged in corruption. But the critical piece, if you go to the next slide, I want folks to really gather in on this. Union membership by sex and race. Right? The largest group of folks in this country who are officially in the trade union movement are Black people. Right? And this is comparing 2 years. I mean, it is noting a drop, right, in union density from the cuts that were being made during the first Trump administration. So in 2018, Black union membership was 12.5, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. In 2019, the close of that year, it was 11.2. So a full point and some change down. And then if you look at the next large in terms of rising, right, by race, is white and then Latino, i.e. Hispanic within this chart. None of these are that high. None of these are that good by terms of standards of what workers can extol in terms of higher wages and better working conditions from being part of National Labor Relations Act recognized entities, i.e. these unions. And it's only gotten worse, and it's gotten intentionally worse. But one of the critical things, just want to highlight about this particular piece, and you go back, you look and you compare where folks are primarily employed. I want everybody to understand that a large part of the federal government workforce, that is the area where Black people, particularly Black women, are most heavily concentrated. So this is not a race-neutral program that is being executed. It is being executed for very clear political, kind of historic lines to attack certain communities and their political affiliation, knowing that the vast majority of Black women in this country are supporters of the Democratic Party, i.e. the opposition to Trump. So this is a concerted program to destroy his opposition and destroy the organized force that might have some a power and capacity to challenge their program, particularly in a systemic basis, by not complying with certain orders or slowing the machine down in their execution. They were very crafty and very smart in going after these particular sectors. And this, be mindful that, you know, the Republicans and even some Democrats never wanted public sector employees ever unionized to begin with, right? And that was a fight, and it took a while for that to even be recognized. And if you read it, the National Labor Relations Act in its original form did not include public sector workers. It was just those in the quote unquote the private sector, which was always minimal within the United States. So showing these figures is kind of showing, in some respects, just the cold reality of what we have to deal with. And the main argument I want to bring to bear and want everybody to grapple with, and to many who might listen to this who are in the trade unions, it might sound somewhat anathema to, you know, the logic by which you know, the movement kind of runs through, and that we need to appeal to the legality of what we're doing. But we have to remember both the age in which we are in, right? And we are confronting fascism on a global scale, not just in the United States, and we're confronting it because of the deep shortcomings and contradictions of the capitalist system on a global scale, right? Its inability to reproduce itself and to secure the kind of profit margins that it wants and ultimately that it really needs in order to survive and keep the machine going that has been running short now for decades. And when capital can't produce how it wants to produce, when it can't rule by force of persuasion, it resorts to outright open coercion, and that's what leads to them calling on the dogs, and that's the era in which we live now, right, on a global scale. And so we are going to have to really dig deep, as Tim would say, into the toolkit to figure out how we're going to fight back against their political kind of machinations, if you would, but also more importantly, to engage in the broader dynamic of where the system itself is running short of meeting our fundamental needs. And one of the critical things, you know, to note that we should learn and must learn just as a class, coming from our recent experience, and I'm talking about the experience of the pandemic, right? It is a problem when some critical items are only produced in one or two countries, and those one or two countries are half a world away. This is not China bashing by any stretch of the imagination. I want folks to understand that. But our little project, Cooperation Jackson, in the height of the pandemic in our community, like in March and April, when we first started feeling the real effects of COVID-19, and we first started feeling those effects with some of our members who were houseless, just stopped showing up to our programs, and then later find out some weeks and months later that due to inadequate, you know, sanitary conditions, due to the lack of personal protective PPE equipment, that they had no masks, no gloves, no hand sanitizer, that they died from exposure to COVID-19. And our community, like most of yours, those of you in the United States anyway, you remember beginning in April, there started to be shortage of the was it the M90 masks,
95,
right?
Yeah.
M95 masks. Why? Because the vast majority of those are produced in China. And under the terms and conditions to kind of halt the spread of the disease, there were major initiatives largely agreed upon almost unanimously by most governments of the world to suspend trade, to suspend travel, so those ships just piled up. But that meant that there was acute shortages in communities such as ours, you know, poor, impoverished Black working class communities, and folks were dying. So we took it upon ourselves to start making masks. And wind up being in a capacity to make a critical impact in saving, you know, we'll never know the actual figures, but the fact that we were able to give out thousands of masks, primarily to folks in our community, particularly houseless folks, we know we made a critical difference in making an intervention just by the number of people who did not die, who were within our pervy. And so I'm highlighting this from a direct experience on highlighting the need, and this is, goes back to the community, or goes to the community production piece, which is our next one that we're going to do, issue number 5. Why we need to look to kind of relocalize certain aspects of production to not be dependent upon ultra vulnerable and overextended, hyper overextended supply and value chains to meet our particular needs. And let's understand, despite all the Trumpian rhetoric, how those value chains got created. Because he tells a story that the presidents before him were stupid, and that they allowed the United States to be abused and to be exploited, et cetera. Do not believe one word of that at all. Please, anybody, particularly the folks looking at this. Because what happened was the corporations and the capitalists which run this economy decided to go to places like China or Vietnam, you know, Taiwan or Mexico or, you know, Chile, Argentina, because the labor costs were lower, the environmental standards were lower, or they didn't exist. And so they found populations and or created situations in various countries where they could better exploit the labor that existed in those in these regions. And they made these critical decisions beginning in the 1960s to counter everything you saw in those graphics and the curve and the upswing of working class forces getting better organized, exerting more power, more influence, and control to kind of inhibit or distort, if you would, or shape the labor process, what got produced, when, under what terms, under what conditions, and then all that impacted profitability. The capitalist system itself, Trump is making kind of somewhat a deranged anti-capitalist argument in what he's arguing. It's an argument that is not fundamentally understanding the overall relations of productions. It's a mafioso argument of just kind of extolling tribute and extract. If you look at, in fact, what he's doing right now on his trip through Southwest Asia, in Saudi Arabia, in the Gulf states, he's just extracting tribute, basically, right? He went there. He said to us all that he went there because they were willing to pay, and that was a condition of his foreign diplomacy, and his, that they were willing to, think in the case of Saudi Arabia, buy $1 trillion worth of U.S. goods, largely in the weapons arms trade, you know, which is one of the only areas where the United States, probably that and entertainment are the only areas where it kind of has a dominant kind of a positionality within the overall, you know, productive relations and productive cycles in the United States. So not playing into the same rationality or the same reasoning why he's trying to quote unquote bring production back to the United States. Our logic and their logic, even though they may sound the same, I want folks to understand and why I went on this road, that the what the critical difference is. We are trying to create a system wherein the fundamental goods and services that we need are not dependent upon a highly vulnerable supply chains and value chains, nor will they be contingent upon exploiting labor in other countries under extremely severe conditions. Knowing the other part of the story about U.S. capital shipping their factories over to China, Vietnam, Mexico, etc., also had to do with them through the CIA and other things creating favorable regimes, right? Taking out the legitimate leftist governments, if you want to call that, you know, the any nation state a legitimate entity, but taking them out And you can just look at the track record of CIA interventions and assassinations and regime change operations all over the world, basically from the 1940s through the present. It is deep, is replete, and covers almost every square inch of the planet. That they created terms and conditions, they created regimes, which would basically subject their workers to the most, you know, depraved, depressed working standards and conditions. It's not like folks chose to be cheap labor. You know, the conditions of capitalists through colonialism and imperialism created these conditions very intentionally and deliberately, and it's up to us to unchange that. So we are making that argument, number one, that in the here and now, if we want to really advance and change the fortunes of labor, that one of the critical things in the United States that we have to do is really organize outside of the narrow confines of the National Labor Relations Act. We need to jettison that and its logic entirely, and recognize the nature of the age that we are in and what type of organization it requires, right? Because it's not like capital, these corporations are operating within the confines of this law. They've done everything within their power to break the law, subvert the law, and they have very successfully. They've employed new forms of technology to reorganize the entire productive process that we, you know, at this point have to adapt to and catch up with and create new forms of organization that deals with how the productive process itself is currently being run and operated. And we don't just want to catch up. We want to be ultimately in the driver's seat. And so one of the critical things that we want to bring together is noting that we don't just want workers to organize unions to just bargain and barter for better conditions. It's insufficient, folks. We need to be thinking of how do we organize ourselves in such a manner that ultimately we are trying to cooperativize and socialize the entire productive process, starting with these particular enterprises and turning them into worker-owned co-ops that can then federate and change. And that's a long way away. We're speaking to kind of what would be. But we have to recognize that the existing trade union structure is basically being destroyed. Although we're in a period where there seems to be a small deal of revival, but that revival at best is still only, you know, it's going to reach about, in its current form, about 20 to 25% of the working class that are in certain sectors that are being targeted and what folks think are organized or that can be organized. So we have to go beyond that framework, and we have to really look at organizing folks on a new basis, right? And organizing people at the points of production where surplus value is being made, but also at the various points of service, right? Where people are providing counseling or healthcare work or aid work. We have to go into organize folks in all of these different fashions in a critical way, and organize them on a class-based basis, not a sector-based basis, but a class-based basis. This is not particularly what I'm arguing. I want folks to understand is not inherently new. This is in the U.S. history, and to an extent in a global history. Aspects of what we're arguing for could be found in the organizing kind of orientation and model of the industrial workers of the world, the WAPIs, the IWW, and even before that in the United States and Knights of Labor, a very class-based oriented, not the kind of dompers, specialized AFL-CIO, which he was the president of, trade sector basis. We have to move beyond that. If we're going to be able to be in a position to really push capital and push the government to go in a new direction. And we want to argue, and we will perhaps in some more detail, we're running out of time now, the need to start organizing on this basis, starting with, again, that scaffolding. So if we're doing the mutual aid work and the food sovereignty work in our communities, we start at that level of organizing. We want to organize in places where we live, in a place like Jackson, where we want to start by organizing everybody who has to earn a living to make a wage, by making a wage, everybody within one big union, and create broad, as a kind of a critical step, creating broad community-based union shops or organized shops that then collectively deal with changing the terms and conditions under which we labor and what we produce. That is the critical model that we want to put forward. And the critical piece to this, we would argue, just in closing, that we have to build the relationship in the here and now to move us in this direction where we're not just vying for better working conditions, but trying to actually, appropriate and then repurpose and to socialize the means of production and getting those who are in the trade union movement to work towards, like I said, cooperatizing these instances. We have to form a partnership that brings unions and co-op together. We've been calling this our union co-op initiative. It's been a major struggle, but it's something we have to ultimately do on a local level to get many of the trade unions to kind of buy into it. But it's a critical piece that we have to move into to rearticulate the class, the power of the working class in this country, and not, view it as just kind of a small sector activity, but a comprehensive activity that encompasses us all. And for that to do that, where we start, and we'll share these tools, we need to build class-conscious cooperatives as a critical base, and we need to build class-conscious unions and have them work in a strategic framework, first at the local level, then at the countywide level, and I'm staying within the kind of a U.S. framework of logic, then at the state, and then ultimately at a empire-wide or national-wide level, and building upon that piece. This is the next critical piece in the scaffold, y'all, that we want to really highlight. There's more details, which we will kind of outline by sharing these tools and resources and putting more resources up both on our website and social media in the coming days and weeks, but just wanted to leave you all with this basic framework as a starting point that we can build upon. So I'll stop there, Tony, and leave it open for questions.
All right, y'all, that's it for now. Thank you again, and we will catch you on the next one. Peace.
Perkins, an urban ecologist. Growing up in Chicago, I remember seeing a lot of house sparrows in my neighborhood, downtown, and even inside the McDonald's at Navy Pier. While my classmates shrieked in terror at the little birds flying around the restaurant looking for food, I recall looking at them in fascination, wondering how they got here. The house sparrow is native to Eurasia and North Africa. However, these birds were forced to adapt to many places around the world. They were brought to the U.S. by way of Brooklyn in 1851 to control pesky caterpillars. House sparrows now live in cities on nearly every continent, where they get hate for being urban pests. But I admire these birds and can't help but see parallels between house sparrows and the story of my own ancestors. Taken from their home range and spread throughout the world for a purpose, forced to adapt, and now they thrive. A true story of resilience. This week is Black Birders Week. To learn how to participate, follow the hashtag Black Birders Week on social media and visit birdnote.org. I'm Deja Perkins.
This is Bird Note. I'm Dara Miles Wilson. Grief settles in the body like an overcast sky on a windless day. Heavy, unmoving. At least that's how it felt on the day of my cousin's funeral. On that June morning in Camden, South Carolina, the world felt hushed, aside from my family's tears. Our collective grief colored everything in lackluster gray. Well, almost everything. Shortly after the procession began escorting my cousin to his final resting place, I spotted a flash of vermilion. A red-headed woodpecker appeared mere yards away from me. The first one I had ever seen with my own eyes, or what birders call a lifer. Its vibrant colors were a bright spot on an otherwise dark day. Later, while I walked in the woods on my uncle's property at twilight, an eastern whippoorwill called out from the trees, steadfast and distinct, right as dusk thickened into night. Another lifer, another extraordinary gift. I didn't expect to find joy as I wandered in the wilderness that evening. But joy, as it turns out, appears before us in the most unexpected places at unpredictable times. As I remember my cousin, I hold tightly to this message from the birds I saw. Joy does not wait. It simply arrives, even in the midst of sorrow. For Bird Note, I'm Dara Miles Wilson.
To KBOO Portland at 90.7 FM.
Goodbye.
To kick off Pride Month and celebrate Portland's LGBTQ+ community, KBOO will be hosting Queer Joy Fest on Friday, June 6th from 6 to 10 p.m. at the Foster Food Carts.